call the Joint Senate and House Education Committee to order. Today is Wednesday, April 24th at 2019. Time is 8:33. Senators in attendance are Senator Birch, Senator Hughes, I'm sure Costello and Vegas Wee Long Soon, myself, Senator Stevens, Representative Drummond, if you'd call the roll.
Good morning. Thank you, Senator. Members of House Education present are Co-Chair Representative Andy Story, Representative Delana Johnson, Representative Greyer Hopkins, and myself, Co-Chair Representative Harriet Drummond. Representative Rivak has the flu this morning, so I'm glad he's not here. All right. Thank you.
Thank you. It's I always appreciate the House and the Senate Education Committees getting together. I think we do this more than any other committee in the legislature, and it really works well. We have common interests and common concerns and common goals, and we're hoping to do some meetings this summer with Senate Education and hope that we can work it out with the Senate House, with the House Education as well, and have that take place. So we have a quorum, a presentation being offered by Mr. Mark Foster. Pleased to have him here. Mr. Foster is a financial performance analyst, a former CFO for the Anchorage School District, and currently a member of the Anchorage School Board. Any comments or questions before we begin? Okay, very well. And we have Representative Tuck with us as well. Thank you very much, Mr. Foster.
Thank you. If I may, today we'll look at several questions, looking at how Alaska students are performing on standardized tests. We're looking at what drives the variation in the standardized test scores. We'll look at how we measure teacher effectiveness by looking at their growth in test scores and how the students are doing on their proficiency. We're going to identify schools that are performing well above expectations and then draw on those schools and the superintendents and principals and teachers of those schools and ask, what are the key factors driving their success? And then we're going to relate that back to national and international research and how we can extend those successes across the state.
Mr. Ross, are you comfortable with people asking questions before you get to the end?
Please ask along the way. I'm happy to sort of stop. I think that's frequently more productive and engaging for the conversation, so thank you for that opportunity, Senator.
Thank you.
Disclosures, caveats, and limitations. Let me highlight on the caveats and limitations for everyone. The NAEP, the National Assessments, and the PEAK scores for Alaska are standards-based tests. They are one way that we measure student success. Variation in the test scores are frequently related to factors outside of the control of schools, poverty being a prominent one. We'll talk about that today. I want to remind folks that when we look across the sort of the spectrum of how we measure effectiveness, the Gates Foundation provided very useful and insightful research, and they looked at it and they said, growth and proficiency are one domain. The other important domains to consider when we're thinking about student performance and the performance of our teachers in our school systems are peer reviews and student assessments as well of how well their teachers are engaging them. So it's not just test scores, but we're going to focus on that a lot today. There are other factors to take into account.
So, Mr. Ross, how do we know whether kids are having success in life? How do we follow that? Do we have any information that would really makes sense to me that it's not just tests, it's social skills, but what do we have to fall back on to prove that?
We have recently, starting in about 2014, peer-reviewed data that's been published. Raj Chetty is one of the folks that we'll reference today, who's developed administrative data that looks at how the kids did in school, followed those students as they graduated, and followed them into their jobs, and looked at their incomes into their 20s, and in some cases the administrative data even goes further. So we can measure what's the relationship between various inputs, whether it's a test score or social skills or graduation rates, and how much money they're earning in their 20s. So we can begin to look at success in life and basically look at what makes a difference.
And probably no information on Alaska-specific, is there?
We don't have a data set for Alaska on that specific measure. You'll find we do have some Alaska data that's part of some national data sets that we're beginning to explore, so we can start down the path of making those assessments.
Thank you, Ms. Foster.
If I could, thank you. I'd like to note for the record that Representative Zulkowski has joined us. And Alaska actually has the workforce database that the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education maintains, and which we extended last year through the memoranda of agreement among the various departments that share in that database. And it's called a P20 database from preschool all the way through post-secondary and early workforce. And the Department of Labor was specifically invited into that. And I think if we're smart, we will make we're forcing the ACP to go out for grants to collect that data, but we should be supporting their data collection so that we have answers to exactly the question that Senator Stevens just asked. There is no reason for us to ask Gates for for money or anybody else who's doing that. We already have that in place, and we have staffing to maintain it. And I think it would behoove us to find a way to get that moving sooner rather than later. Many other states maintain similar databases and can tell us the answers to how their kids are doing based on the inputs in school.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Foster.
Thank you. Page 5, one of the questions that was frequently asked in the national data on the national assessments was to compare how well we are doing in reading in the National Assessment of Education Progress. On this chart, what we show across the scale on the bottom is the eighth grade reading scale score from 2017. You'll see the score goes from 245 to 285. And on the y-axis, you'll see the fourth to eighth grade reading scale score growth from 2013 to 2017. So we're looking at those fourth graders as they grow in their reading to the eighth grade, how many points do they pick up on those tests, and then we plot that against that where they land in the eighth grade and compare that to other states. So what do we find? We find Alaska is in this chart one of the high growth states, that is to say, where the kids start in the fourth grade, they get moved rapidly to higher levels of performance in the eighth grade relative to the rest of the states. They start at a lower base, but they have higher growth. And that's a pretty consistent pattern when we go back in time looking at the reading scores in Alaska compared to other states. So when we perform this basically for the prior sort of four cycles where we have data available, you see a similar pattern. Alaska is a high growth state, but remains at a relatively low base. And the challenge is when we look at the next slide and we find that in math we have a different result. And it is a similar challenge that we've had in prior periods. Alaska remains in the low growth and low base quadrant in math between fourth and eighth grade. And so that, as a state, puts us in a spot where we do have some challenges there that appear to be persistent.
Thank you. We have a question before we do. President Hannah, if you would care to join us at one of these tables up here, we'd be glad to have you.
Thank you, Mr.
Yes.
Chair, and thank you for being Senator here, Hughes. Mark. That one and the previous one about reading is growth as opposed to achievement, I think, and it reminds me of when I was a little girl, I got an award for being the most improved ice skater, but I was jealous of the girl who actually was the best ice skater, and it's like I didn't really want to be the most improved, I wanted to be the best. So that is telling us we're doing really well, improving between fourth and eighth grade, but where do we land as eighth graders for reading as far as what we've actually achieved? Are we up in that quadrant for achievement, or is it just showing the rate of growth there?
If you look at the x-axis, the eighth grade reading scale score, Alaska is in between sort of the 255 and the 260 zone, and 265 is the national average. So as you look from left to right, you can look at proficiency in the eighth grade. So you'll see we are behind the pack in proficiency, and it's true in both the math and in the reading in terms of where we get to relative to the rest of the states.
And just follow up, so the farther to the right, the higher the proficiency.
That's right. So you're looking at the proficiency score across the X and the growth across the Y.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. Anyway, and I do want to highlight the math does remain a challenge relative to the reading because it winds up in the low growth and low base score. When we look at our PEAKS data for Alaska, we've looked at fourth grade and eighth grade English language arts, fourth grade math, and eighth grade math, and plotted that across the state by school. And so we've attempted to sort of show how those scores go, and you'll see the proficiency scale goes from red to green. And if they're right at 50, they'll be very light colored. You'll see a few of those data points. And that gives you a sense of the distribution. We do hope to expand these maps, so not only does Anchorage get blown up in so you can see better, but we get Kenai, Matsu, and Fairbanks, so you have a little more discrimination and you can see the schools in your school districts. There's, a continued interest, at least on the part of Senator Von Imhoff, on producing these scores in a way that they're relatively accessible and people can sort of see the performance. Let me point out a few things here in the fourth grade English language arts that I think are noteworthy when we look across and look for high-performing schools and ask what are the differences in those schools. You'll see Unalakleet in Western Alaska is continued to be a high-performing school in reading, and you'll see several Southeast schools that do quite well in reading that are relatively rural. Kenny Lake comes out and doing quite well. So there's a lot of variety even when we see sort of clusters of challenges, and so one of the things we've done is to look for the successes and try and understand what those keys to success were.
Yes, please.
Thank you. Thanks for your presentation. So what determines the size, the diameter? Is that the number
of students taking the test?
Okay, thank you. So not necessarily, is there reasons why students wouldn't be taking the test?
There can be reasons why students are taking the test. By and large, we only report here on those test results where there are enough students taking it for it to be a statistically significant.
Okay.
So that's one of the other criteria. And there's also privacy criteria. If there's below five or fewer taking the test, we wouldn't report on that as well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Eighth grade, English language arts, you'll see some similar stories about success, and you'll see a few new ones emerge. There's a few new green dots emerging, and there are others that lag behind. So even though we have the sort of statewide pattern where there's good growth from fourth to eighth grade, it clearly varies across the state depending on where you're at. So we do see a lot of variation, but I would offer that we have success stories here as you look across the green on the 8th grade English language arts. And you'll see a fair amount of green there in southeast and green bands in most of the, what I'll call, suburban school districts, which we frequently refer to as the Big Five. Fourth grade math, we have the same plot. We have pretty good results in many of the schools across the state. You'll see there's a fair number of green where we can ask, what's your sort of keys to success? There's some green. You'll see Unalakleet again up in the North Slope, and many in Southeast as well. Eighth grade, consistent with the NAEP scores, you'll see there's a significant reduction in the amount of green that we see across the state as we get to the eighth grade math results. So remember, I've got two different tests. I had a NAEP test looking at eighth grade. Now I have a PEAKS test looking at eighth grade, both of which are looking at proficiency and have similar results. We don't see the growth and we don't see the proficiency relative to other states. We're relatively behind on math.
Mr. Chair.
Yes,
thank you. Thank you. I'm also seeing significantly fewer bubbles in the eighth grade results on both of them. Is that fewer students taking
fewer
them?
Schools?
Fewer schools participating.
Each, right, because each bubble represents a school, and the number of middle schools or schools with eighth grades in them is considerably smaller than the number of elementary schools that we have in our school districts.
Exactly. It's about right. It's about half. Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
So what drives the variation in test scores? What are we measuring? And frequently when we look across test scores and try and understand them across the grade span, one of the things we find is that poverty, affluence, that continuum, drive a significant portion of the variation in test scores. Frequently around half of that variation in test scores is household and neighborhood poverty effects. And the Gates Foundation, when it looked at how do we measure successful teaching, focused on that and basically said, if we want to look at how teachers are doing, we want to factor out poverty and look at how they're growing their students, regardless of where they might come in to their class. How do they take those kids and grow them and give them at least a year of growth in the school? And so what they basically recommend is that you look at growth as the primary measure of how effective you are being at growing all of your students, regardless of where they might start.
Yes, Mrs. Kosky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Has there been any analysis done? So I come from a very rural, remote district in Western Alaska where poverty is quite significant, but has there also been some of the challenges that we've seen in our school systems in Western Alaska are challenges around retention, and typically newer teachers will get recruited and brought out to our communities, and that retention percentage is a little bit lower than some other areas, so it causes some instability in the classroom. There's also significant cultural differences in the classroom. So I'm just curious if any of those have been identified as also being factors that contribute to the variation in test scores.
The short answer is yes, and you'll see later where we identified high performers, interviewed them, and in those places in rural communities where there was performance, and then they asked basically their peer group, why are they having challenges? The items you mentioned were at the top of the list. Hard to attract and retain teachers, cultural challenges in terms of just differences between the teachers and the local community, and some of the items that you mentioned. So that's actually documented later here in the presentation.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
On the left, we're looking at the percentage of school-age children in poverty by school district. On the right, we're looking at the average test scores by school district in grades 3 through 8 from 2009 through 2013. At Stanford, they took a review of all of the state standardized tests, mapped them to a common scale, and then compared that to a grade level, and then measured whether students were at or above their grade level, which is the deeper green on the right, or whether students were falling behind their grade level, the purple shading. So you can see above and below grade level on that right-hand side. So that's performance. You look on the left, you're looking at poverty across the United States. Compare this back and forth. Poverty in the dark blue and below grade performance in the purple. You'll see there's a significant correlation. There are a few notable exceptions. I'll leave that to you guys to sort of sort through the maps and go, aha, there's a few states where there are pockets where there's a difference. But by and large, poverty is a significant portion, and it's not just an Alaska problem, it's a United States challenge.
President Grubb?
The looks like Stanford either ignored Alaska and Hawaii on the right, or it got cropped out of the map.
They didn't produce the map. I did follow up with Sean Reardon, the professor. We do have the data. I haven't had a chance to put it all together and map it yet.
Okay.
We'll look forward to that.
In the state of Washington, we had a fascinating presentation here last week by Representative Christ Tompkins for his, I believe it's House Bill 128, National Teacher Board Certification. All we're going to be doing in Alaska is recognizing that we have nationally board certified teachers. But he told us that in the state of Washington, they started giving out bonuses to first get teachers to go through the process and get nationally board certified, which takes about a year, and it costs the teacher about $2,000. And that's what we're expecting our teachers in Alaska to do, is pay for it themselves. And their kids will benefit. In Washington, they started paying an additional bonus of, I believe it was $5,000 for each bonus level. The second bonus went to teachers annually. It was as an annual bonus in addition to their salary to keep them in high poverty, economically disadvantaged schools. And I know that if I blow up that map of Washington, I see that green spot right in the middle of it. I'll bet you we're going to find high poverty districts in rural Washington that have, and the most astounding statistic that Representative Christ Tompkins told us was that the number of teachers that are nationally board certified in Washington went from 9% per school to 35% per school of nationally board certified teachers. And in Alaska, we have about 90 teachers in the whole state that are nationally board certified. That's like 1/5 of a teacher per school, if you spread it out among the schools. But I got so excited by that in terms of getting highly qualified teachers to every student. It is so critically important, and this map is going to show us that. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
When we take the Alaska data that we saw on the prior maps, looking at fourth grade and eighth grade English language arts and math, and we look at those schools, and then we plot their performance as percentage proficiency on the y-axis against percentage economically disadvantaged along the x, we see the correlation between poverty and test scores for our Alaska schools. For those different sets, and you'll see in both English language arts and in math, whether it's fourth or eighth grade, we have similar correlations. for statewide, somewhere around 40% to 50% typically of the variation on a simple one-factor regression is related to poverty. When we've run this for two- and three-factor sort of models and look at what's driving the variation, poverty remains the single most important factor. And many of the other factors that you think might be related tend to get swamped by the poverty factor when we're running the regressions, and they don't turn out to be statistically significant. So you want to be careful when you're looking at larger models to really ask the question, are those next few factors that big relative to poverty? Poverty does tend to dominate these equations. When you pull out the dots and just look at the curves and look at fourth and eighth grade, and now I pulled apart rural, southeast, and rail belt. English language arts, you'll see we do a decent job of improving scores from the fourth to the eighth grade in rural Alaska. The very highest poverty districts and schools have a challenge, but with less poverty, we're able to increase scores from the fourth to the eighth grade in rural Alaska. Southeast and Rail Belt were essentially within the measurement error. We're not making much progress against the poverty. We're basically doing about as well in the fourth grade and the eighth grade as we did. We're doing as well in the eighth grade as we did in the fourth grade. We're not making a significant difference over time. So it's very interesting to note that, in fact, there is some real significant work being done in rural Alaska. It's just not lifting the most impoverished schools. It's lifting those in the middle range and above. We're seeing a difference. People are basically getting growth in many of those districts, so that's a good thing. Math remains a challenge. As you'll see, the eighth grade math across all of the areas, rural, southeast, and rail belt, come down off of where they're at in the fourth grade. So I think math remains a challenge across the state. As we look at the test scores. All right, so now we're looking at fourth grade reading, and I'm looking at percentage proficient and the percentage economically disadvantaged. And at each school, and then basically asking myself, who is doing better than you would expect given their particular level of economic disadvantage? Which schools are the high flyers relative to that poverty headwind? So we identified those high flyers, fourth grade, eighth grade in English, and in fourth grade and eighth grade math. And we proceeded to ask those superintendents for of those schools, why are they doing well? What's the secret ingredient that enabled them to perform above expectations given their particular economic circumstance? What did we find? In the Rail Belt and Southeast, a consistent message came across of highly experienced and effective teachers was critical, a community of parents that valued education, a generous and supportive municipality. One of the high flyers that the Commissioner of Education has mentioned is Skagway. When I asked the mayor of Skagway, what's the difference? The local community support, not just in were there supporting, but were there with the financial resources to make the difference too, to help them hire the teachers. So Stan Selmer can testify to that. The other thing they found is the kids respond to our practices. They work hard. They come with a desire. The biggest threat those successful schools found as they look across, there are sort of opportunities and challenges set, was instability in finance and instability in policy. They're really looking to build a successful team of teachers, parents that support their kids, and then get to work. Rural challenges dominated the conversation, as does the challenging test scores. The rural districts found high teacher turnover rates, and with those districts with those very high turnover rates, they often graduate less than half of their students. And there's a cluster of low reading and math proficiency in those schools and those districts. They're trying to find ways to engage the students with courses that are local, culturally appropriate, but it's still a very challenging environment.
Yes, Representative.
Thank you very much. Are there specific school districts or schools specifically that have done a good job with the culturally relevant curriculum for their students in rural Alaska?
I think the short answer is yes. But rather than me try to remember the specifics, let me follow up with you and give you the names of the ones that I think consistently in our data set show as doing well and doing well on culturally relevant. Because I want to make sure I get both of those together when I give you the answer.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Hawkins. Representative Zafosky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a follow-up to Representative Hopkins' question, and I don't want to get ahead of your presentation, but have local subject matter experts discussed any barriers, whether it's within the Department of Education or from the statewide level, in providing culturally relevant curriculum? Is that potentially also a resource issue?
I'm not sure they've characterized it as a resource issue in the conversations that I've had. I think it's mostly been characterized as an understanding of what is culturally relevant for a particular community relative to the standardized test and what it's measuring. So I think there's a tension between those on the ground going, the test that you've developed might be fine for a suburban environment. I'm not sure it's relevant for a third or a fourth grader in my particular environment. And so I think that's where we get feedback and people expressing concern, is that the first few tests may not be as well adapted to measuring what's culturally relevant as it may be in some other places. So I think that's the conversation that I've been hearing.
Follow up?
Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you've kind of threaded that needle really finely in terms of the challenge that we consider when we're having conversations about making sure that we're providing culturally relevant education, place-based education, but also wanting to reach a certain standard. And that always seems to be an unspoken understanding among policymakers, is that there are challenges in areas where there's a significant cultural dynamic and poverty dynamic, but we can never seem to wrap our arms around it because we continue to come back to these conversations about standardized tests, but also recognizing that they don't work very well in some of these communities. And so I appreciate your recognition and acknowledgement of that.
Yeah. Let me offer a couple of observations that date back to the 1970s in my own school experience in Fairbanks. The most culturally relevant instruction that we had in one of my classes was basically teaching hunting and fishing in our science class. And it was the most one of the most engaging classes that we had, and everybody in the classroom was engaged. So I think there's a lot to be learned across the state from sort of rethinking what's culturally relevant for all Alaskans. And I think there's some opportunities in science, especially, sort of just reframe it around what could we all learn about our local backyards that would be very interesting and engaging for our students. And I've seen some of that work emerge, particularly out of Fairbanks, in basically the science from the university informing some of the high schools, and then that pervading down into the lower grades, middle schools and elementary schools, so that science really becomes local. And so when I see that model transferring to other rural areas, I see more engagement. And I just happened to have had the opportunity to visit places like Tuntutuliak, Napaskiak, and when I see that happening, then I go, I think there's promise here. So I think there's some space there for that dialogue to actually move forward and create some opportunity.
Yes, please, I'm sorry.
Thank you. Yes, we have certainly seen that in the Juneau schools too. And I guess it was a year ago, we adopted the new science next generation standards, and we have over 20 community members working for 2 years on that curriculum, and it's place-based. It will appeal to all of our youth being raised in Southeast Alaska.
Thank you. Next few slides are just some reinforcement that a lot of what we're hearing from the folks in the field in Alaska who are doing it every day, in fact, match up quite well to the national and international studies about what are the factors related to student achievement. And so I'm sort of pleased to report that we really are using not just sort of what do we hear in the field, but it matches up to the research. What we're doing is frequently informed by the data, and it really is about what works to help students learn. And that's what those several slides are about.
Question.
Please,
sure.
Representative Darwin.
Thank you. Mr. Foster, can you explain what you mean by students ready to learn?
Sure. I'll go to page 24. And when we're interviewing superintendents, what they're reporting back from their principals and teachers is that the kids come to class wanting to work hard and do well. They're motivated. It's clearly a high value in the community and in their household. And I think some places where that might not be as high a value, the teachers basically are making up for that frequently through social and emotional sort of learning and persistent skills, and frequently trying to help the kids learn how to get along and get ready to learn so they're not playing with each other, they're working on their schoolwork. So I think there's those dynamics that are at play. So that's, I think, what we're talking about when we're talking about ready to learn.
As the late Representative Max Gruenberg used to say, can we dialogue instead of asking for permission to follow up? All the studying that I've been doing looking at reading and the task force on reading proficiency, we're looking at, are kids ready to learn when they enter the school experience at kindergarten? We're testing them at fourth grade, but where are the differences in kids being ready to learn and how they're being supported by their families and communities when they enter the schoolhouse, because 5 years later you're going to test them on how they're doing in reading and math, but how ready are they for those 4 or 5 years of instruction that's going to teach them to read? And if they're not reading proficiently by the end of third grade, testing them in fourth grade is only going to tell you what you should have known 5 years ago when that kid enters school. So let's look at what it means to be ready to learn. I mean, you know, a third or fourth grader may be able to come to class wanting to work hard and do well, but how does that translate to a five-year-old? And how do we measure that in terms of how we get them ready over those 4 or 5 years of instruction for that fourth grade reading assessment? Never mind the math part.
And if I may, let me go ahead and highlight one of the factors here.
And which factor is that?
Do we need a laser pointer? It's very small.
It's the factor that basically says, are we teaching the right material at the right time to the student? Is it developmentally appropriate? So as I look across the grade span, whether it's pre-K, kindergarten, first, second, or third, we want to make sure that our expectations and the material are lined up for that student wherever they're at, so that we're helping them to stretch and grow from where they start and not have an expectation that's unrealistic, either high or low. And that's one of the critical elements about being successful across the grade spans, is to basically keep that expectation rising just a little bit ahead of where they're at. And recognizing that among students, there's going to be variation in every class that you have. And the challenge is across those classes is to raise all those students. That's daunting work. Mm-hmm. If you've ever been in a classroom trying to teach to every student in your class, that's hard work. And I think it's important to just acknowledge and understand that's one of the big challenges that we face. And I think it's a bigger challenge in Alaska than many other places, because we have diversity not only between schools, but within schools and within our classrooms. Frequently that diversity within a class of 20 students is as great as the diversity between schools and between school districts. And so I think it's really helpful just to remember that that's the challenge that we're asking people to meet every day in the classroom.
Mm-hmm. Sort of stacking up here, we have a question from Senator Hughes, Representative Story, and Representative Hopkins.
Thank you, Mr. Foster. We've all heard about the Finnish model, where they wait till children are 7 to really begin to teach them to read. And I think of the child, you know, we have a lot of children are late bloomers. Boys tend to be that way. And so we're putting them in kindergarten and pushing them on through, and they're not perhaps ready to learn, and all of a sudden they're behind the rest of their cohort all the way through, and they must have a sense in their little minds that something's wrong with me. I'm not good enough. I'm defeated. I can't keep up. And it just makes me wonder, and you could let us know if any other states do this, should we be testing students to see if they're ready maybe before or after kindergarten to see are they really ready to move on? Should we be holding some children so that they don't start first grade maybe until they're 7, and then they'd be more successful when they got there, and it would help along the whole spectrum, so that by fourth grade, I think Representative Drummond really hit on something as far as this readiness. And just because somebody has a birthday and turns a certain age doesn't mean they're magically ready to learn to read. So would you think that some kind of assessment before or after kindergarten might be helpful, and do any states do that, and has it shown any success?
I don't know about the nature of the particular assessment. I can report that in the literature, there's certainly a discussion about when it might make sense to make sure that students are developmentally ready to go on to the next level. And there's certainly evidence that there are some positive impacts by having essentially an evaluation of whether the students are ready to move on from kindergarten to the first grade. So there's evidence in that space that there are some positive impacts, particularly around behavior issues, to make sure that the students are ready to work in a group setting and perform in that setting. So I do think there's some promise there. I don't know that it's assessment per se. I really think it's primarily focused on behavior issues in that very early kindergarten level.
And follow up, and I know there's been a lot of work done as far as reading and literacy, and I'm just wondering, because there's debate about whether you should have a retention component in any of that kind of work, whether if as a policy call, and perhaps over the summer, if we're having joint meetings and discussing these things, whether it would make sense as part of that effort to really think about whether a child should be repeat kindergarten, because and I think in Senate Finance anyway, you talked about retaining kids at later grades can be problematic because they're very aware that they're being held back. But when they're little, when they're only 5 years old, oh, they get to stay in the kindergarten class and play another year. I mean, they're probably not going to be socially, emotionally, psychologically impacted as they would be at third grade. And so that's just something we might think about as if we're going to do some kind of literacy policy, is that kindergarten level. Because I think the success of the Finnish models has to do with the children are so ready that they just launch once they hit 7 years old. They're ready to read, and we could avoid a lot of struggles, I think, with some of our children and kind of being labeled. I hate to see a child that struggles at kindergarten and first grade being labeled as a poor student, a poor reading, you know, always being in behind the rest of the class. And so to our co-chairs, I just ask that maybe we consider that over the summer and the fall, if we're looking at those kind of policies for our state, that we think about kindergarten and readiness, and whether we ought to have some kind of I know it has to do with behavior, but you still have to assess their behavior and should they repeat kindergarten. Thank you.
Great point. Thank you. Any response to that? We have several folks I have several folks in line.
It's all right.
There's any Story, Hopkins, Drummond, and Hannon. A response to that, please. The dialogue is nice, but we also have to have some control. Everyone doesn't get a chance to express their beliefs. Okay, then we'll go to Representative Story.
Yes, I wanted to go back to the students ready to learn, and you're talking about students appearing wanting to work hard and be motivated and have a lot of support from family. I'm wondering if they did any talking about adverse childhood experiences, because I find a lot of families under stress really want their kids to do well too. Just there's a lot of factors involved, and also students experiencing stress, which is across economic levels too, that it's hard to learn when there are stresses that you're facing. So I'm wondering if any of that was talked about. And I would like to comment that many of our schools in Alaska are becoming trauma-informed schools and educating their staff about ACEs and how at school can have set routines and have interventions to help with that.
The short answer is that wasn't high on the list, keeping in mind that we did a self-selection of folks who were doing well above expectation. And that's what we were focusing on. What was the success factors that were driving it? What we didn't do was ask among those who changed over time from sort of below expectation to above, what did you overcome and how did you overcome it? And we largely, because we don't have a long data set on these test scores, it's a short score, so we really don't have a lot of room to identify ones that are coming up the scale. And then I think two, even among the folks who have the challenges that were mentioned in some of the rural schools, it wasn't first on the list of their concerns. This really reflects sort of what was the high on the list, and it really was what's been alluded to before. It's, I'm having a really hard time getting a stable environment here in the school for teachers and just for the students from the perspective of, I got a lot of teacher turnover, and so, and a lot of perhaps sort of lack of understanding about how things are different in their particular community than where they came from. And so I think those are the things that were at the top of the list as we talked to folks. But certainly there's a lot of conversation going on outside of this particular study about trauma and how that impacts students and how to adjust your instruction to take that into account.
Thank you. Representative Hopkins.
Thank you, Senator Stevens. I'm going to hopefully try to figure out how to frame this question. I've been thinking on it for a little while. It's on page 26. You've got the K-12 investing in effective measures to support student success in life. And you have three of those boxes pointing to those different factors on the left side.
Yeah.
Then on page 27, you have those same factors on the top, but that list of factors of all the bars is now related to student achievement, being test scores, NAEP and PEAKS. And the two boxes over on the right-hand side are now used to show where they are and how this helps student achievement on test scores. Does that mean that the home and community support and early literacy and culturally relevant education is not as critical to support student success in life, and on by those same measures, fairly low on student achievement and test scores?
No, I would say they're all critical elements to success. So I think when we talk to the folks who are performing well above expectation, all of those factors were ones that came into play. And really what we're showing here is the impact that they have from national data sets to reinforce the notion that in fact these are factors that we see in the research supports what the subject matter experts are telling us locally. So we have collaboration from research and local subject matter experts. That's what we're trying to show here.
Thank you. Can I just repeat that back to them to make sure I understand what he
says? Yes, please. Thank you. Hawkins.
So on those, in terms of success in life and test scores, students ready to learn, home community support, and effective teachers are the three biggest factors in there for test scores and success in life.
I would say all five are required. I wouldn't characterize these as the biggest.
Okay.
They just happen to map to the research that have large effect sizes.
Okay.
And what I'm trying to validate is the what I'm hearing from the subject matter experts is that in fact validated by research, and that's what I'm concluding is that what they're saying not only makes sense in their environment, but it's backed up by what we see in peer-reviewed research about what makes a difference.
Okay, thank you. And then one follow-up, class size doesn't factor into it as much because there's no arrows, or is it just on there because it's important as well?
The research in support of class size is on page 28.
All right, I'll be patient.
Yeah, I see that.
Okay, yeah. Thanks. We'll get to that in a minute then. Representative Drummond.
Thank you. I found it fascinating when Senator Hughes mentioned the Finnish model that doesn't teach kids to read until, is that age seven? In the Anchorage School District, when I was on the board in the 90s, when charter schools were established, one of the first applicants was a Waldorf school model. And many board members couldn't get over the social background of Waldorf, but what stuck with me was they did not begin to teach their kids to read until age eight. What they focused on was music and art. They had kids painting paper. You would get notes from Waldorf students that was on this gorgeously painted watercolored paper that was deeply textured, and it had drawings on it. It may not have had words on it, but you could tell that they were developing their kids' brains. You know how art and math impact the ability to learn. Waldorf has had it right for centuries, practically. And it's too bad we didn't pay attention to them and just start doing exactly what they did 25 years ago. We'd have been a lot further ahead. But I am looking ahead at dividing a class of 30 students into two of 15, I assume, would increase total earnings of students by more than $600,000. That's class size is critical. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Drummond. Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Through the chair, much like Representative Drummond, Senator Hughes's comments about Finland reminded me that the other component when we look at Finnish reading programs is they have universal pre-K programs starting at age three that focus on sound development and auditory speech and then move into letter recognition before they begin a reading program. And instead, because we don't have universal pre-K, we expect all of those skills to be developed at kindergarten or first grade whenever that child enters. And so we find that much of kindergarten and first grade, we're identifying speech defects and sound recognition issues that in a preschool program at age three and four are identified, developed, and focused on before you go to the written language, but you've had significant focus on language development and grouping before the most concrete measurable element of that of can you read the book, can you write those? And of course, in many Finnish kindergartens, kids are starting to read and write before seven. That's just when the formal instruction program. And I'm wondering, Mr. Foster, if any of the districts we've identified as high-performing have been some of the districts across Alaska that have taken a focus on pre-K programs to develop those reading skills and ready to learn. That's, you know, when we students ready to learn, it's the social emotional following instruction, sound development, number sense, as well as are they well fed? Did they show up to school well rested? So that trauma informed stuff that's sometimes linked to social emotional, but there are skill developments that preschools focus on. And I don't know if we had that data differentiated for you or if all of our pre-K programs have been pilot and so we don't have test data that correlates to NAEPs and MAPS and PEAKS.
Thank you for the question. I haven't looked at it. I'm thinking out loud and wondering if I have enough administrative data to match up the pre-K programs that I'm aware of, and they're pretty scattered and pilot in nature. So I'm not certain it'd be interesting to look at. I'm not certain the data set's rich enough and deep enough to be able to draw statistically significant conclusions. And just thinking out loud, the pre-K in Anchorage is predominantly funded through special ed funding. Mm-hmm. So I've got a subset there, a little bit of pilot program. Yeah, I worry that the data set might not be sufficiently robust to be descriptively very interesting, but I don't know about statistically. Yeah, I'm sorry.
That's a great question, and maybe we'll come back to you later and ask you to think about that further. Okay, thank you all. Very wonderful discussion. Let's continue. We're going to try and be done here by 10 o'clock. I think we have other things folks have to do, but yeah. We have about a half an hour to go.
One thing I do want to highlight on page 28, I would say relatively recent research from large administrative data sets by Raj Chetty out of Harvard, looking at, and literally these are data sets where he's got millions of data points, where he's trying to see what makes a difference in how do we get better outcomes in our schools. And he was looking at better teachers, better classes, better technology. You'll see the three pictures there at the top. And based on the large data sets and then looking at earnings into the 20s, he's basically concluded that there's good evidence to support that you want effective teachers in small classrooms. That's where you get really good returns on your investment. And so you'll see the source there at the bottom where you can go and look at quite an extensive bit of information about how they determined the various analysis that they did, the data sets they used. But essentially the takeaway is, if I divide a class of 30 into two, I increase the total earnings of those students significantly. And the cost to add a teacher in that room is a lot less than that investment. And so the return on the investment is frequently 4 and 5 to 1 if we're looking at outcomes for student success in life. So there's a pretty interesting bit of research there that makes you want to go, that's worth looking at and seeing what we can find in Alaska and how it might apply and where it might apply effectively here. So I think that's it's very much worth consideration.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate this conversation now that we're on slide 28, because I used to teach at the Alaska Electrical Apprenticeship School, and I can tell you I'm teaching adults. And even teaching adults, when you go from 15 students to 21 students, and I know that sounds really, really small in comparison to the class sizes that our public education teachers are faced with. But you cannot give the attention to everybody that you would like to give the attention to, who needs attention to. Even your top students need attention. And you can't ignore your top students, because oftentimes what I see happening is I have to rely on the better students to help me teach the less apt students. And when you're teaching skills and you're teaching, and it's very math intensive, once somebody falls behind on their math skills, it affects the rest of their learning career, the rest of their apprenticeship. And so you want to get those foundations down. And so we did limit our class size, and I only chuckles because it seems really ridiculous in comparison to the class sizes that we have with young people. But yeah, we reduced our class sizes down to 16 as a result of that. And so I appreciate this, because it's not just in teaching young children, but it's also teaching adults. You gotta have the ability to give your attention to all the students.
Thank you, Representative Tuck. Senator Birch, and then Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the presentation today, Mr. Foster. I kind of keyed in on the success in life, and I noticed that you have it's a financial component, and I know that probably works in a traditional sense if you're from Harvard and you're looking across the country and trying to find nationalized. But I remember working with people where success in life was having a moose in the freezer and fish in the freezer for the year. I remember working with people that were living in cabins that without water and basically were very proud of the fact that they could live in and around interior Alaska for next to nothing. And I guess I kind of look at that, and even on the other end of the from the education standpoint, if you have I've volunteered with the developmentally disabled, and sometimes success in life is being able to hold down a job for a number of years. And so I guess I to the extent that we are outside the boundaries of the bell curve there in many respects, certainly number wise, I guess I look at that success in life as being kind of squishy as far as the boiling it down to a heart, just to that number, the income potential. And I realize you have to do that if you're looking at it at a national level. But how do you take into account like the outlier communities, and we have a lot of them in Alaska, aside from a handful of what you might call more urban areas? But I'd be interested in your perspective on
that. Thank you, Senator Rich.
I think the short answer is the one that the Commissioner of Education has been developing over the last few years, and that is engaging local communities about what does success for your students look like. So taking it from what might be more of a suburban, urban environment where we're really looking for, you know, are my children going to be successful, have a job, be able to, you know, get a house, have a family, sort of those things, to looking at other communities and going, sort of, how does this look in your community to relate back to your stories? It, you know, as we know from interior Alaska, we got a lot of folks out there who enjoy living close to the land. So I do think it's really about shifting our perspective and making sure it's connected locally and sort of culturally relevant.
Thank you. Senator Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. And I don't know if, I doubt the data had any opportunity to look at it this way, but looking at pupil-student ratio, frequently school districts and communities get stymied of the idea of doubling the physical capacity and how impossible that would be and what a cost would be. And I have looked at this before and said, it's doubling the number of adults. So you can change that ratio by just putting a second teacher in every classroom. So you've got that 1-to-15 ratio with two teachers in there. And, you know, there, people get into the dynamics of the personalities instruction, but a second set of adult hands working for the same goal, being able to divide a population differently when those kids who need a little more physical activity need to be brought outside to run around for 15 minutes, and then they can come back in and focus. And every teacher dreams of having that flexibility, but you rarely get that opportunity. If you have enough special needs students in your classroom, you might have a teacher's aide, but having two certified teachers in the classroom produces nearly identical results as dividing the class into two groups of 15 with separate classrooms. So don't get stymied by the idea that the capital investment and physical capacity would prevent that reduction in ratio from happening in many communities, because we can do it in other ways.
Oh, good point. Thank you so much. So we have a lot of slides yet to go, but let's make an attempt to move ahead.
The key takeaway on those large, long-term returns from effective teachers in small class sizes is we need to make sure that that group of new teachers that we're hiring in to help shrink the class sizes are highly effective. And that is the challenge that we have, being able to attract and retain top teachers, and especially at the entry level. I think Alaska faces a continuous challenge in attracting and retaining, and I think we're going to see that as a factor that continues to daunt us as we go forward and look at how do we increase our achievement, given that these are some areas that demonstrate promise. I'll conclude there with the main presentation and the takeaway that when we talk to folks who are successful, it really is those five factors that we've identified. There's a community that's supportive. The students are really interested and engaged. They want to learn. The teachers are effective. They have small class sizes. And there's culturally relevant education, and sort of early literacy is a foundation. Because once you fall behind, that's a very daunting challenge to make up.
Well, thank you.
Sort of engage any questions people might have.
Thank you, Mr. Foster. So I think we made the assumption that, I assume it's still true, that locally grown teachers are best, that we're going to have a hard time filling our teacher requirements from outside of Alaska. I'm very concerned the university has decided to close the School of Education in Anchorage. It seems to me that is a mistake. But maybe they can find a way to still provide an education to our students through the other elements. But is that the right way to think, that we would be better off if we get more Alaskan kids into teaching?
It's certainly possible if the teacher preparation programs are robust and effective. I think we've been at it for a few decades now, and I'm not certain that we've made a lot of progress. Let me offer a counterfactual that might be of interest. When I got to Anchorage and looked at our performance data and our financial data across 2000 and into sort of the 2014 timeframe. One thing we noticed was that we got an influx of teachers, 2008, 2009, who came from the lower 48 as their economy went down and the Alaska economy stayed up. And the quality of the teachers that were attracted to Alaska was high. So I wouldn't dismiss the ability for Alaska as a destination to attract good quality teachers. So I don't want to dismiss that aspect of our ability to pick up folks who are interested, engaged, and want to make a difference just because they come from outside. So I do think there's some positive data to support that. I do think it's interesting as I look across the data from that time period, the teachers from UAA, teachers from UAF, teachers from the Southeast prep programs compared to outside. We had a chance to look at some of that data, but remember that's now 4 years ago when I was inside the shop looking at it. We believe there was a self-selection going on, but we had good quality preparation from Anchorage in that data. There is nothing to suggest that that program was less effective at preparing those entry-level teachers. Looking at practice scores and then looking at how well they did in the first few years of teaching and how they were evaluated. So I would say that's another bit of information that would be useful to consider as you think about what are the opportunities and challenges that we face.
Thank you. Representative
Story. Yes, I see there's some more pages in your presentation. Are you going to be continuing with them?
No.
It seems its returns on our investment pretty important.
Yeah, we can touch on a few of those. Some of it's just reminding folks that when I'm doing comparisons, I'm going to adjust for cost of living, whether I'm in the health sector or K-12 sector or in any of the other benchmarking that I do in utility work, and basically say, how do we perform relative to other places after I take out cost of living adjustments. So there's a series of slides on that, 32, 33, 34, 30, and that's really prep for 35. So when I talk about return on K-12 investment, I am looking at cost of living adjusted dollars. So cost of living adjusted dollars per NAEP score growth in reading, how do we do relative to the other states as an investment? Well, as it turns out, we're just outside of the high value, high growth quadrant in terms of our dollar investment, looking at that 2013 to 2017 investment space and growth in test scores from the fourth to the eighth grade. So I would offer that the schools in Alaska are providing reasonable value and close to the high growth, high value quadrant of the 50 states. And you'll see we're above average on growth and just outside of the average on a cost per growth unit basis. So on a return on investment, we're doing okay.
Mr. Hawkins.
Thank you, sir.
On reading.
I don't actually have a question on this one, so you're all right on that.
And then the I do think the challenge remains in math. I think we fall outside of both the high growth and high value quadrants on math on page 36. I do think there's room to be made up there.
Thank you. Did you have a follow-up, please?
I do indeed. On page 29, you circled highly effective in the big box. You have highly effective equals growth across skills, knowledge, and social skills. to prepare students for success in life is what a highly effective new teacher does, is work on those social skills. And then on page three, you have the number three caveat that says social skills are actually a better indicator for success in life often than test scores.
Yes.
Can you talk about what some of those social skills looks like and how we measure those?
Sure. I would reference page 39. There's a decent study put together by Professor Jackson that's reported out in a more popular press form in the Education Next publication in the winter 2019 edition. And he's looking at, while we use test scores as one measure of progress, they don't necessarily match up to success in life. And so he's building on the emotional, social and emotional data sets and measures and looking at how that compares to success in life and beginning to show that motivation and self-restraint and sort of factors around those two things are really critical at being successful, and that to the extent that we focus on that and ensure that's part of what we do in teaching, in fact, we tend to prepare students as well for success in life by focusing on that as we do chasing test scores. In fact, his research there, if you look carefully, the probability of graduating from high school is highly correlated to behavior and motivation and self-restraint, and only modestly correlated to test scores. So he's really making the point that what's important is probably not test scores relative to these other factors. And I think his research and subsequent research continues to build on that to suggest if you want to predict long-term outcome, test scores may be relatively poorly correlated compared to some of these other factors. That's independently sort of verified. Let me see if I can find it, if I put it in here. In some of the work that Chetty did looking at early test scores only account for maybe 5% of the factor in those earnings at age 25 through 27 there on page 38. So it's really the social motivation and self-restraint activities that you learn in a group setting, how to get along in a group, how to learn in a group, how to work together, that turn out to be pretty important.
It's really fascinating, and I would suggest that anybody who goes into politics is probably really good at social skills. So,
not behavior, but at least. Well, thank you. That's really fascinating. Any other questions? I'm sorry, Representative Sorek.
Yes, I wanted to go back to effective teachers as one of the most important qualities, and my question has to do with how the districts measured that experience and or what qualities they looked for to give that determination. And I want to say that we do have many small classroom size across Alaska, not necessarily good and good returns. So I know class sizes are small, are very important, but I know the quality of the teacher is critical. And I think about Finland, and all their teachers have their master's level, and they have they're very well regarded in society, like doctors, and are treated very well, and there's a lot of incentives for them. And I think how we as a system and our role as legislators in having predictable, reliable investments for districts to plan is critically important, because when we talk about teacher turnover in Alaska with not putting our funding in at correct times, it affects urban districts too in ways that I think some people are not aware of, and that is when you wait to obviously we get pink slips, but what happens if we don't come through with funding? Teachers have to move. The lowest person who came to the school and might have been there for a few years has to be transferred to another school in the district, and you do not get that continuity within the building. And then you might be hiring teachers back, but that teacher has already moved from the building and is at another school, and a different teacher comes into that school And so that dependability, that relationship that you've developed with kids in the grades does not continue as we'd like in bigger districts. And so it is critically important as we as policymakers, as we are looking at these timelines and certainty, that we come to grips, I think, with how to best do that. But I'm getting away from my question, and that is, how did you assess what was an effective teacher?
We didn't independently set a criteria. We asked the subject matter experts for what they thought made the difference. And clearly the theme that emerged was effective teaching. And I think for them, the superintendents, principals, and others who are identifying effective teaching, it's really a peer review analysis about how well do they do with their class. And I think, at least in some of the subsequent follow-up conversations, it's how well prepared are those students for the next teacher that gets them in the grade progression, because you get to a pretty good idea from that grade progression who's doing a good job at preparation the year before, and you begin to see that in the data as well. And so you really are building over time, and if you get a progression of good, effective teachers, you really do see that upward trend on proficiency across standardized tests in addition to the social and emotional skills, the motivation and self-restraint. You really do see it. Whereas from time to time, if you don't get a good teacher in that progression, you really do see the fall off. And so that's, I think, what you're getting when you have those conversations, is the peer review, and it happens to correlate with test scores. So we didn't look at test scores. We were really doing the peer review, and that's what we're seeing.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any further questions or comments? If not, any thoughts in summing up, Mr. Foster?
Thank you very much for the opportunity to share what we've learned. I do want to thank Senator Von Imhoff for her work in the school board, because that's really what enabled me to dive into the data back when I was in Anchorage and then expand that data across the state so we could have a better understanding of how the challenges were similar and different from Anchorage and other communities, so we could begin to formulate really sort of a broader view of how does this system work together. Because as you may be aware, Anchorage does tend to get new teachers from out of state, somewhere around two-thirds. They frequently get distributed around the state and then come back. And so there really is an attraction retention issue that starts there and then winds up affecting other parts of the state. So we're really trying to develop a more of a statewide perspective of how the system works together. So I wanted to just publicly thank her for that opportunity at the school district to explore that. You know, other folks were more concerned about Anchorage, and she had just a broader view of how the system worked. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Foster. We are all in this together, and I really appreciate your coming back to Juneau. I know you probably had not planned it, but I appreciate your accepting our invitation and returning to see us. Representative Drummond and Representative Torrey.
Got some final thoughts. Thank you so much. I almost wish we had committed two-hour sessions or, you know, 3 hours total to this conversation, because it's so important. And I appreciate Representative Story's concerns about fiscal uncertainty. We also have a benefits problem in that teachers are leaving, not just teachers, public safety employees, all kinds of people that we invest in large quantities of money to train and bring to the state, and they leave because our benefits packages are subpar to the rest of the country. And we're not doing our folks any favors if we don't look, at how to attract and retain highly qualified teachers in this case. So I really appreciate all these numbers, and I'd like to do a deeper dive. Maybe if we do some joint meetings this summer, we could continue. And I do have some questions that a constituent has been watching and has sent questions, but I didn't think it would be fair to inflict them at this late point in the meeting. So I'll send them to you separately, and we can share the answers with the questions and answers with the rest of the group. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Very good story.
Yes. I'm sorry. I missed. How was this study funded?
Basically, a significant portion of it was done prior to with the Anchorage baseline information, and then Senator Von Imhoff engaged her staff, Jonathan King, to do some of the follow-up, and then she asked me to come down and sort of finalize the work this session.
Thank you.
Thank you. So the Senate Education has been talking, committees have been talking about doing some meetings in the interim, talk to the co-chairs, and we both expressed an interest that we might work together on this, and that might very well be the case. The problem is going to be to find the time that we can all get together with so many of us, but I think it could be particularly valuable, and I appreciate the willingness to all work together on this. And I think we stand out in the legislature as being the one committee that seems to be willing to work together, and I certainly appreciate that. Again, thank you very much, Mr. Foster. Appreciate your being here, and we are adjourned.
I have a quick announcement.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you, yes. Senator. Please join us tomorrow, Thursday, April 25th at noon, right here in 106, for a special demonstration about the importance of computer science in Alaska schools, hosted by the Alaska Council of School Administrators and the Alaska Staff Development Network. Kid experts will be teaching us how to do computer coding, and I understand I'm going to be one of the guinea pigs, a field where there are many good, high-paying jobs needing to be filled. Food and beverages will be provided. Please spread the word and see you here tomorrow. Thank you. Thank you, Senator.
Sounds great. We'll adjourn at about a minute before 10.